chick flicks, romantic comedies, rom-coms. You love them, you hate them,
but we are here to eviscerate them. Welcome to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast.
We are your hosts, Eliza Bertrand
and Janelle Walker. Now, let's get on with some feminist joy killing. In today's media, we often talk about the concept of representation. And I personally am a fan of not just any representation, but quality representation. And you know what kind of quality representation I want for all of us? Is quality representation in absolute shit garbage films that Netflix makes at Christmas. And this week we're going to be talking about an example of such a progressive move. Hi, Eliza.
Hey, Janelle. I really enjoyed this week's movie.
Yeah, I have to say, I was all ready to be very critical and hate it a little bit, but I was charmed, and that is rare.
Yeah, really. Both of us charmed by a Netflix Christmas movie? That may never have happened before.
I don't think so, actually. I don't think Netflix has ever produced a film that we have both agreed was good. So kudos, Netflix. I give all glory to Kathy and Jimmy for this one.
Yeah, she really, I know everyone's talking about, you know, the obvious standout character, but I do think that that Kathy and Jimmy did a really great job as the like very stereotypical mom, but like still making her enjoyable. So well done on that one.
Yeah, I mean, before we get too deep in our favorite characters, I guess we should say that we this week are talking about Single All the Way, the year of our Lord 2021. Here is your plot summary. Desperate to avoid his family's judgment about his perpetual single status, Peter, played by Michael Urie, convinces his best friend Nick, played by Philemon Chambers, to join him for the holidays and pretend that they're now in a relationship. But when Peter's mother, played by Kathy and Jimmy, sets him up on a blind date with her handsome trainer James, played by Luke McFarlane, the plan goes awry. Well, Eliza, that's what Google says Single All the Way is about. But what is this film really about?
Okay, so Single All the Way is about, oh my God, they were roommates. And all your other favorite tropes from shitty, shitty, fantastic stories on the internet. It basically, this whole thing reads like a fanfic, but like a fanfic of these kind of Christmas rom-coms, which I guess it kind of is, right? Like, finally people got a hold of the means of production and the power to make one of these rom-coms and get it on Netflix, and they were like, what would I do to make it better? I'd make it 1,000 times gayer. And that's what they did. So, you know, it's, this movie is about the gays, capital T, capital G, little TM at the end. The whole beginning of it is like, this movie is about gay people. Oh, in case you didn't get it, this movie's really about gay people. But also I would say that this movie is sort of like, it's like the message is the gays are valid, and so is the small town's traditional American lifestyle.
Mm.
Like, it's like the gays are just like us. Just like us.
Yes. I feel like most people in our listening audience are not looking for a radically queer Christmas rom-com, but I am, and that's not this movie. So if that's what you're looking for, listeners, this is not it. This is for your absolute pink-washed, homonormative people who are all about, like, give me my marriage equality, gay wedding registry at Williams and Sonoma, or give me death. And you know what? Why not?
And they're valid, too.
Absolutely. But there's a lot of intelligence in the writing, I think, about that, right? Like,
no,
this script is so aware of what it represents as the gay Netflix Christmas rom-com. And like you said, it is really smart in some ways about just acknowledging the stereotypes and the cliches and the pitfalls, and actually not just acknowledging them and dispatching with them, but using them to great comedic effect, I thought.
Yeah. I mean, look, obviously the representation of, you know, queer representation in our mainstream media is incredibly small even today. But within the admittedly quite small world of mainstream queer representation, I feel like there's an even sort of smaller element that is just like queer joy and just straightforward, like, happy representations of, you know, true gay stories, right? Like, there is the entire world of, like, the serious gay movie and the sad gay movie and the it's gonna win an Oscar gay movie. But sometimes you just want light and fluffy and, you know, acceptance and niceness. And, like, that's what this movie presents. And obviously, like, there's also a need for that other stuff and for a whole other realm that I think our, you know, mainstream media still hasn't really accessed. But this gives us something that we really don't have a ton of examples of, which is just, like, it's queer, it's fun, it's enjoyable, it's accessible for hopefully most audiences. And, you know, that's okay.
Yeah, I agree. I think that this movie demonstrates as a really interesting case study moments when equality is good, but not necessarily progressive. And that's extremely right. Interesting, right? Because in a way, like, this movie, one of its sort of subplots is acknowledging the economic power of gay men specifically. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think this is a little known sociological fact, but it's true that gay men in the US, because there's a wage gender gap, and gay men are less likely statistically to have a whole load of dependents. They have the one of the higher average household incomes as mm-hmm. a demographic, which is very interesting, right? And I think this movie, especially because Peter works in marketing and he specifically works in gay-oriented marketing, mm-hmm. and so much of his story with Nick is about money and starting businesses. You know, it's very much, I think, in conversation with that phenomenon that, yeah, now that we've passed sort of these, like, base level equality measures like marriage equality, now we're at a point where we can say, like, hey, you know, the great thing about the gays, they have money. And they have money for Netflix, you know?
Right. Like, this movie is sort of acknowledging that, like, the gays are consuming this, you know, Christmas rom-com world as much as the straights are. And so, like, let's throw them a bone and include them in it, because then we'll make more money, which, you know, is capitalist and evil, but it does give us this fun movie, so maybe it's okay.
Yeah, I love that I said I was super charmed by this movie and I jumped right into criticizing it for not being radical enough. But yes, let's talk about the ways that it is, like, super, super charming. I mean, one of them is that this cast is a stroke of genius. Like, I would not necessarily have put all these people together in my fantasy cast list, but the chemistry amongst them is excellent.
Well, and I have to say, as much as we're going to talk a lot about how this is just, like, a straightforward Christmas rom-com and a straightforward, like, you know, big city kid moves back to the small town thing, this did, I think, actually do that better than a lot of the other movies that we talk about on this podcast do. Like, it just sort of, it wasn't, you know, an award-winning movie, but it just sort of upped everything a tiny notch. And part of that was that, like, the whole family and all the side characters all felt really fun and interesting and enjoyable. You know, a lot of times you get, like, the overbearing mom or the perfect sister, and then there's, like, other family members who are in the background opening presents. And here I felt like both of the sisters had their own personalities, all of the nieces and nephews had a purpose. Both of the parents were really fun. I don't think either one of them sort of overpowered the presence of the other one. You know, and then you get the absolute powerhouse that is Jennifer Coolidge just coming in and taking center stage for no reason other than why wouldn't you have her do that? And it just, every scene was really enjoyable with all of them interacting.
I just love that Jennifer Coolidge is at the height of her career somehow, even though she's been acting for like 40 years. Like, I'm sorry, the line, "All the world's a stage and most of us are desperately under-rehearsed," is just absolutely genius, and her delivery of it is incredible. And again, the character of Aunt Sandy sort of lampshading that she is kind of a classic fruit fly, you know, camp embodied figure that gay men are supposed to be obsessed with is delightful in this movie. But she doesn't necessarily play that role, right? They kind of acknowledge that they could go that way. And she even says, like, "Gay men are obsessed with me." But the gay men in the story aren't really obsessed with her, you know?
Right. Yeah, no, it kind of felt like someone just gave Jennifer Coolidge a couple of drinks and then shoved her into the middle of these scenes. And I don't mean it felt like Jennifer Coolidge, the actress, was unrehearsed or improvising. I mean, it felt like she was not in fact playing Aunt Sandy, but playing a drunk Jennifer Coolidge who had just wandered into the scene.
Yes, exactly.
And that was a stroke of comedic genius. But then again, to have the rest of the family hold their own when you've got that happening is really impressive. And, like, I have to shout out to the two nieces who I thought were possibly the best part of this movie.
A surprising delight. The meddling children are rarely charming in these movies, but they were very good.
Yeah, so for those of you who haven't seen the movie yet, the older sister has two teenage girls, and they're quite close with Peter, our main character, their uncle. And they immediately are the ones who clock that he and his friend Nick should be a couple, even though everyone else is busy, like, trying to find a date for Peter. And the two of them decide that they are going to use, like, the power of 2021 teenage, you know, abilities and somehow connive a situation where the two of them will, like, realize that they're in love. And they're genius at it. It's adorable. It, like, feels plausible. You know, they don't pull off any, like, crazy heists. They just sort of keep kind of cornering people and being like, yeah, don't you think that the two of them would be great together? You know, right? Like, it feels teenage and sort of, I don't know what's the word I'm looking for. Like, it feels a little kind of sloppy, but it works.
Yeah, I feel like what I loved about the teenage girls particularly was that there was this beautiful moment where they were sitting in the stairs, and I think it's when Peter and Nick first arrive, and they say, like, those two should be together. And it's a nice moment because it's part of a running gag in the movie where Kathy and Jimmy are saying, no, I've finally gotten over the fact that just because Nick and Peter are roommates doesn't necessarily mean they're a couple. Gay men can be friends with each other. And these two girls, as our sort of representatives of Gen Z, are like, no, actually, in this case, like, they should. No, it's okay. Like, we're not actually the end of the stereotype. This is, like, a thing that's happening.
Right. Well, and you get the impression, like, the mom, as played by Kathy and Jimmy, is the whole family is very supportive of Peter and his life and everything that means, both of him, you know, being gay and having this life in LA and whatever. But you get the impression that the mom is, like, really trying and has educated herself over the years about how to be a good mom to your gay kid. And you get the idea that, like, the teenagers are just, like, modern American teenagers who are familiar with the concept of gay people and don't have to, like, try that hard. So having them be the ones who sort of connive to get these two set up together, I think works better, because you don't think they're going, oh, you're a gay man and you're a gay man, you should date. You think they're going, oh my God, you two are so cute and I super ship you and I'm going to make this happen. While, yes, the mom's exactly, like, trying to be, like, a good mom and not just assume that any gay man would be perfect for him, but instead find the gay guy in town who she likes and who also serves her, you know, purposes of trying to get her son to move back home. Right? Like, it, so it somehow comes across a little less like, oh, this stupid family.
Yes. Absolutely. But even though, like, the jokes of Kathy and Jimmy being, like, reading a book called How to Love Your LGBTTT Child are hilarious. Absolutely hilarious. And it's nice because, you know, I think we now live in a world where, for the most part, and I don't want to speak too broadly, but I would say that certainly from the time when we were teenagers, being out to your family has changed as a thing. Mm-hmm. Radically. So it's really nice to see that cultural shift represented in such a mainstream movie.
Right. I mean, this movie, for as much as it is still about the two leads being gay, it is not about their gay journeys. It is about the fact that they are falling in love, right? And, yeah. You know, it does so in a way that is quaint and in a way that is kitschy and, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And again, it leans into all of the sort of gay stereotypes and the gay jokes, the sort of wink, wink, nudge, nudge at the camera if you're, you know, on the inner circle of urban gays and you understand our obsessions and that's why we have a plant gay starring in this movie. You know, like, it's got that kind of stuff.
It's so funny! Like, I'm sorry, like, that is the best thing about it are all these little jokes that say, like, hey, gay community, we see you, we know the jokes, we know the stereotypes, okay. And you know what? If Hallmark movies are going to have basic white bitch cliches, this movie is going to have basic white gay man cliches, and that's okay.
I mean, we know that the best moment of this movie is when he got a really obnoxious text from his boss, and he just whispered to himself, flames, flames on the side of my face.
Eliza actually screamed. I was like, I cannot believe that they just inserted a GIF into this dialogue, basically.
Right. It was perfect. And again, it felt like it was very lovingly written, right? Like, this was written by someone who, like, really was enjoying writing this script and performed by actors who were enjoying performing it. But it wasn't about him having to deal with his family not understanding his lifestyle, or him having to come out to his mother, or him having to, you know, right? Like, it wasn't any of this. There was no, like, high school ex-girlfriend who came back into the scene and confused him. There was no, you know, need to explain to everyone in town what it means to be a gay man. Like, he just sort of came home and everyone was like, why don't you have a boyfriend yet? And you could have, in those moments, literally inserted the female star of any of these other Christmas movies and you wouldn't have changed the dialogue at all. And that was really refreshing.
Yeah, and I should say, like, some behind-the-scenes insight for our listeners is that last year we considered covering The Happiest Season, and after some feedback from our queer femme friends, we decided not to, for the reasons that Eliza just sort of alluded to, that it was a movie that was not about queer joy, that was kind of rehashing queer trauma in a way that was not necessarily productive or helpful or quality representation. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's definitely really great that this film just embraced, like, yeah, okay, so what does the Hallmark Lifetime movie equivalent for a white gay urbanite look like, right? And I think that, right. that it's really great that this movie did so much of alluding to those, you know, tropes from this very well-tread genre. Like, for example, Peter is, you know, he is hooked up by his mom to a local hottie, small town local hottie. But in the end, he doesn't end up with that small town local hottie. He ends up with his love, you know, his, like, true friend, the person he has a long-term relationship with, a good foundation with. And they move together to small town New Hampshire. So it really splits the difference. And it also has a nice sort of resonance with that bit of that cliche of, you know, gay folk retiring to Vermont. You know, like, there's all sorts of beautiful stuff wrapped up in that. That's just fun and fluffy.
Yeah. Well, and I feel like there were a bunch of places in the movie where, again, the movie was so sort of aware of what it was. And so it kind of kept trying to fake you out, right? Like, he doesn't end up with the small town, you know, guy. He ends up with his city boyfriend. He, like, you think there's going to be a run to the airport, but then they don't even make it to the airport before they have, like, the big, you know, romantic, right? Like, there were things like that. Like, again, they were having fun creating this movie and kind of playing around with your expectations. Now,
absolutely.
All of that being said, I do think we need to talk about the ultimate message of this movie, which is that, like, you can go off and be a cool, hip, liberal, urban gay, but in the end, you will still want what these movies insist everyone wants, which is to move back to a small town, back to your family, settle down in a honestly fairly heteronormative relationship, because this relationship had the soft, caring plant, you know, partner, and the good with tools partner. Like, it's still, again, you could replace one of these, you know, the main lead with a female, and a lot of the dialogue would stay the same, which, as we said, is in some ways pretty radical, but in other ways is, like, they still think that him going off to be a big media executive in the big city was, like, a bad idea. It made him unhappy. What made him happy? Moving home and working on the Christmas pageant.
And opening a plant store with his soon-to-be husband, you know?
Yeah. Right, like, it's still, like, everyone has to fit eventually back into their little box. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I just think that we need to acknowledge that that's what this movie is claiming.
Well, there's a lot of complexity there that I think, because neither one of us is a gay man, it's difficult to speak to in too much depth, but we have enough knowledge of the community and enough friends to at least understand that that there is complexity present. Like, I'll say, you know, shout out to my pal Dylan, who I watched this movie with, who, you know, gave me a lot of interesting insights into how he felt about that ultimate message of the movie. Part of that was that, one, I mean, this film on the front end is offering you, as we said, a kind of utopic vision of what it is to be gay, and certainly to be gay in an interracial relationship in this country, in this current political climate. Like, yeah, in some places, not a thing of note for people. In other places, like rural New Hampshire, there would be things to be concerned about, right?
Yeah.
And then on the back end of it, exactly like you said, it is sort of pushing this idea that, well, Christmas romantic comedies are fantasy, and isn't this the fantasy for gay men? Isn't it? Don't you want marriage equality? Don't you want economic power? Right? Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, as Dylan was pointing out to me when we watched it, there is a space with this kind of representation to instead say, to question the normative, right? To say like, no, maybe the fantasy is living in the urban space or living in a collective or breaking apart our economic mm-hmm. strata, you know? But those things, I mean, I would love to see the communist rom-com, don't get me wrong. Like, but that's the thing, right? It's like, that's where we sort of get into a place of are we asking a genre of film to just be something that it isn't? Is that kind of normative right. fantasy baked in so hard that it's unavoidable? That was kind of a question I was left with when mm-hmm. I talked to Dylan about it.
Well, you know, I definitely was thinking along those sort of lines too after I finished the movie, because like we said, there were little things that they changed here and there without sort of breaking the mold of what these movies are. But I feel like there, you know, maybe in the next movie that's like this, there could be a few more little things. For example, you know, they're living, this family is in this, you know, pseudo small town in New Hampshire. Bridgewater, New Hampshire is an actual town and people have heard of it, which means there are, in fact, more than 200 people there. But it's, you know, about 45 minutes north of Boston if there's not traffic. And they mentioned that in the movie because this guy who he dates for a little while says that he's moved up for the season to be a ski instructor and a cycle instructor. But he lives in Boston most of the time. And I was like, okay, so if I'm a black gay man who has fallen in love with a white gay man whose family is in New Hampshire, and they're 45 minutes from Boston. Now, Boston is not the greatest city in the world to live in if you are, you know, not white and straight, but it is still a city with all of the amenities that an urban area provides in this country. And I would say, honey, I also love your family, and I think it's beautiful here. Why don't we move to right outside of Boston, and then you can drive 40 minutes to work every day, or you can drive 40 minutes to your mom's every weekend so you can see her, but we can still be somewhere where there might be one other black person.
Right.
And instead exactly. they move directly into town, and I just felt like that was asking a lot.
I have to admit that as a Southerner, I did not really get New Hampshire until I had spent like a good decade on the East Coast. And like when I realized that New Hampshire is the place with the slogan on the license plates that says live free or die, I was mm-hmm. like, oh, so y'all are talking shit about Alabama and you've got that hidden in your backyard?
Oh, like, oh Janelle, y'all. Let me say, as someone who has New Hampshire in my blood, it doesn't get more south without being in the south than it does in New Hampshire. In fact, in the state of New Hampshire, they say the more north you go, the more south it gets.
I mean,
it is like this weird Alabama shoved between Vermont, which is these days this like liberal utopia, and Maine, which is empty wilderness. And again, the tip of New Hampshire touches Massachusetts and is like half an hour from Boston, right? So the tip of New Hampshire, you have like some of the finest private schools in the country. You have a lot of politicians come from that area. You have people who work in Boston. You have, you know, you get concerts and theater comes through and blah, blah, blah. And then the rest of New Hampshire is just the middle of fuck all nowhere with people who do not believe that laws were meant for them. True story, New Hampshire does not have a seatbelt law. Vermont does.
They don't?
When people drive over the border from Vermont to New Hampshire, they unclick their seatbelts. And when they drive over the border from New Hampshire to Vermont, they re-click their seatbelts because there are Vermont state troopers waiting on the other side to pull people over for not having their seatbelts on.
New Hampshire, that is uncivilized. Come on, be sensible.
Live free or die, Janelle.
Oh, God. I mean, as a Texan, I get it. I do. Trust me, I do. But seatbelts? Come on.
Right. So I'm saying if you're Nick, this, you know, black boyfriend who does not have any family left and wants to enter a long-term relationship with your white New Hampshire boyfriend and be near his family, wouldn't you say, like, maybe we can live just over the border in Vermont, babe?
I don't know. Like, who knows? Like, maybe it's ideal and maybe it works and that's great. But I think that it's like you said, it's the message of the thing, right? Which is that that they can't they couldn't possibly be truly happy in a picturesque Christmas way going back to Los Angeles.
It's wrong. Not possible. They have spent 9 years social climbing in Los Angeles so they can get invited to all the parties they want to go to, but they are willing to drop that forever like that. And again, like, we're tearing this movie apart in so many ways, but it really, like, there are so many good things about this movie. And again, when you consider the audience that these very formulaic Christmas rom-coms that come out on Netflix and Lifetime and Hallmark are aimed towards, demographically, it is just a fact that, like, the biggest demographic that watches these movies are white, are middle America, are not necessarily conservative, but certainly sort of politically very midline. Like, this is what the stats on these movies are showing us. And so on a certain level, I'm like, look, if a few people who have had limited experiences with the queer community or with queer media, but like these kind of movies, watch this movie and then it just, like, opens up their mind a little bit, then I think that this movie's accomplished a really great thing. And I'm glad it exists. And I'm happy that that kind of, I'm glad that that kind of representation and that kind of, you know, openness can happen. But, like, as, you know, as a media critic, I also have to think from a larger perspective, what is this saying?
Right. I mean, it's a thing that you notice, I think, as someone who criticizes pop culture, that our progress is not made in miles, but in inches.
Right.
And that is just how culture works and has worked historically. Because the people who are truly radical in the culture are left to the fringes. When you're looking at the mainstream, we are moving inch by inch by inch mm-hmm. by inch. I mean, the fact that we have our first, like, really, truly, like, queer Netflix rom-com in 2021 is kind of shocking, right? Considering
right.
what we've had nationwide marriage equality since 2015.
Right. Yeah, I mean, we're still, like... Again, it's easy for us who live in cities, big cities, who have grown up in, you know, fairly liberal worldviews, you know, around us, even if there were also other, you know, worldviews that we were aware of as well. But, like,
other elements, yeah.
You know, the state of Texas, whatever. My yeah. Catholic family, whatever. But, you know, like, we come from a background where a story like this feels very normative and has for a long time. And so it's easy to take it for granted. But, like, as we know, because of the politics in this country, there are a lot of people who this is still really radical for. The idea that just, like, these two gay men want to be a part of their family and want to embrace small town life and values and want to participate in their religious, you know, Christmas pageant thing happening in town, right? Like, that's not something that a lot of people are, you know, coming into contact with every day in the media they're consuming.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's true. And I think that you're right that one of the many, many smart things, as we've said, about the fact that the film addresses cliches and stereotypes by kind of absorbing them and using them for its own purposes is that it is meeting its audience where they live, right? It's saying, like, hey, you might think that all gay men are in theater, but they're not. Gay men have a wide variety of skills and interests, right?
Which some of them can use a hammer.
Right. Which for us, of course, is sort of hilarious just because Michael Urie is, like, a preeminent white theater gay. But that's fine. Fine, sure.
Yeah, like, it, you know, again, to us, I'm like, oh yeah, I've seen these characters before. I've heard these conversations before. Honestly, the scene at the beginning where they're at the Christmas party after having done the photo shoot, I was rolling my eyes so hard because I was like, wow, are we leaning into the gay stereotypes? Like, they were all, like, holding their hands up in the air and giving each other air kisses on each cheek. And I was just like, oh God, is this what this whole movie is going to be about? And I, one, had to kind of step back and be like, all right, give it a second. Like, let's see where it goes. And two, I do think that that was part of the fun of it, is that they, like, set it up to be, you know, sort of so over the top. And then they kind of let the rather slow-paced, charming movie unfold from there, which, again, with the, like, format of, you know, small town girl escapes to the big city and then returns, having it start sort of so over the top fits the formula, actually. It's just that we don't normally get it quite so, like, queer-coded.
Well, and one way in which they sort of look at that structure but make it sort of more relevant to gay male culture, I would say, that we haven't touched on yet, is that we often talk about how in these movies there's always a first bad boyfriend, you know, mm-hmm. or a bad fiance or whatever. Well, in this film, the bad boyfriend turns out to be a married man with children, a man married to a woman who is on mm-hmm. the DL. And that's a really interesting twist on the bad boyfriend convention that is sort of true to the concerns of the gay community, which I found kind of interesting and cool.
Right. Well, and there's this moment after he's found out, you know, it's the sort of stereotypical, like, cry on the phone to the shitty boyfriend once you found out he's been cheating on you the whole time scene. But Peter goes on to this whole thing where he's like, and you've been lying to your wife and you've been blah, blah, blah. You know what? I'm not here to judge whatever journey you're on, but I don't need it in my life. And then he hangs up the phone. And it's said with the energy of a joke, but it actually structurally for the film is really interesting. And for Peter's journey is really interesting because it's basically saying, like, what's toxic about this guy is that he's still going through this, you know, unhealthy form of coming out to himself and to his wider community. And Peter is so far past that, that he needs someone who also is just in a comfortable, accepted by his community place, which is Nick, right? Like, the two of them go home to Peter's family. And it's just, they're out, and they've been out for a long time, and everyone knows it, and everyone's fine with it. And so it is an interesting twist on the sort of shitty boyfriend that he has to leave behind to find the good one trope that these movies have. Because, like, yes, he was dating someone who turns out was married, but the married thing isn't really the issue.
It is. It's about, like, living out loud, which is, yeah. I know, a common concern. And I think it's also really nice that, like you said, we sort of get in, oh, well, it's nice, but it's also sort of problematic that the gay men we see in LA, right, not counting Peter and Nick, our heroes, are these, like, pretty big bad-ish stereotypes, right? Like you said, the sort of, mm-hmm. like, urbanite, aesthete, you know, condescending type. You have your DL rich married doctor in LA. And then you get to Bridgewater, New Hampshire, and you get James the hot ski instructor, who's like a hot angel.
And who's just adorable and sweet and lovely the whole time. I kept just yelling at the TV. I was like, listen to your magical wise ski instructor.
And he's just so, like, good-natured about everything. Like, there's this scene where he and Peter are playing darts in the bar, and Peter's going on and on about Nick, and James is just like, hey, you talk about Nick a lot. He's so sweet about it.
Well, and he's got, I honestly feel like he's got the kind of energy that, like, you want your SoulCycle instructor to have, which is that, like, he can kick your butt, like, when you're doing in class, but then afterwards he can listen to you. You know, you're like, I totally get why all the, like, middle-aged moms are totally in love with him, because he's got that just, like, very sweet, open energy. And so I think they casted this really well for that. Yeah.
It's a good reminder to all of us out there that sexuality, you know, be damned. A thirst object is a thirst object, y'all.
Although, side note, the guy who they have playing this lovely, sensitive thirst object is apparently in, like, a shit ton of Hallmark movies. He's sort of the one, like, Hallmark holdout in this movie that, other than that, has a bunch of people who are, like, slightly too famous to be in a movie like this. But some of his Hallmark movies include Sense, Sensibility, and Snowmen, Chateau Christmas, and The Mistletoe Promise.
I could have clocked that at 10,000 paces. He has that face. He just has that, like, hot guy at the mall face. Do you know what I mean? Where it's just like, you're hot, but you're, like, a believable hottest guy in town hot. You know?
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's like the, I always joke that my type is farmer's market hot. But I feel like there's, like, a smaller town version of Farmer's Market Hot that's, like, not full-on, like, mountain man, but something in the middle. You know, like, a sort of, like, soft-core mountain man.
Yes, exactly. Whereas, like, you know, you look at Nick and you think, like, that is an actor. Like, that is a beautiful, that is a beautiful man who, if you saw in a store, you would be like, are you a celebrity? Like, I don't know where you're from, but I have seen you on television, correct? Do you know what I mean?
Right. It's that moment from Crazy Stupid Love when he takes off his shirt and she goes, oh my god, it's like your abs are photoshopped. Like, that's what Nick looks like.
Yeah, well, it's, I need to get some snow to cool off.
We'll just bring you up here and throw you into the snow and send you back to Texas. The one thing that I was thinking about after this finished, and I was thinking about, like, the structure of these movies, because we've now seen a bunch of these, right, where it's, again, like, small town girl has sort of her, like, fling in the city where she goes and achieves, like, relative success in whatever her, you know, chosen urban career field is, right? Like, often they're, like, you know, a busy businesswoman, right? They're, like, they're a journalist or they're a marketing exec, whatever it is. And then they come home and, like, throw all that away because what they really want to do is be home. And it's like these movies keep saying that, like, everyone needs some sort of, like, a small town America Rumspringa. Like, you need to go to college for 4 years and then go live in a big city for 4 years. And then when you're 28, that's when we can acknowledge that it was just a phase and you can come home and start your real life in the real world.
Right. And listen, I have never, like, except for my parents' quote unquote small town that they have moved to in the last couple of years, which, I mean, sorry, for Texas, it is a small town. It's still 50,000 people. Mm-hmm. I have never lived in a small town. So if anyone from a small town wants to explain to me if this is true, like, is this a thing? Because I feel like I know, right, like, plenty of there... people from small towns who still live in the city.
Yeah, is there, like, some weird, like, conservative Christian Rumspringa situation going on that we as just, like, actual urbanites are unaware of? Because it just sort of feels like this is a very particular timeline they've laid out that they seem to feel everyone is on.
To close... as part of other things that I don't think are true, I just want to briefly touch on Jesus H. Christ before we go.
Jesus H. Christ, Janelle. Here's my one real question, like my real question that I keep just coming back to, and I really would love an answer, and I don't think I'm going to get one. Why was Jennifer Coolidge dressed as Glinda the Good Witch?
I don't know. I have no idea. I don't know if it's like a sideways reference to the idea of the Friends of Dorothy and the whole idea that Judy Garland is a gay icon and there's like a backhanded reference there, or that's just something Jennifer Coolidge had in her closet, which I would believe.
This is what I'm saying, that she was just playing a drunk version of herself who had wandered onto the stage.
Right.
Like, they were like, if Jennifer Coolidge randomly decided to star in a local Christmas pageant, what would she be wearing? And everyone was like, obviously Glinda the Good Witch's full dress and crown. Yeah, one of the best Christmas pageants I've ever seen in one of these movies, hands down.
Oh my gosh. My only regret is that there's not a director's cut that's 45 minutes long.
Know that. Maybe that's coming out later. The month is not over yet, Janelle.
Please, Netflix. Okay, because listen here. Fun fact about me, you know, I have a PhD in theater and performance studies, so I have a you know, very soft spot for theatrical everything. I love the hundreds-year-long tradition of Christmas pageantry, okay? It is amazing. It is bananas. It is silly. The tradition of towns coming together to put together some crazy shit to say how much they love Jesus is one of my favorite things, and I wanted more. I wanted more. I wanted sparklers. I wanted a pageant wagon. Come on. Somebody do it.
And also, just like one more time, I was struck in the middle of the montage of them making everything and getting everything ready for this pageant that, like, they let these two gay characters participate fully in a blatantly Christian event.
Yeah.
Right? Like, as we've talked about before, some of these Christmas movies are, like, weirdly secular and it's all about Christmas, but they never mention God, they never mention Jesus. This was like, his nieces are playing the Virgin Mary, right? Like, it was a town, but like church pageant. And they let these two gay guys from LA come and, like, help direct it. And it's so nice to see a mainstream movie acknowledge that gay Christians exist.
Yes, absolutely.
Because, like, there are still, I'm still always amazed at how many people I talk to who are like, yeah, like, I'm gay, so I can't go to church. Or I've never seen a church that is accepting of gays. Or I'm straight, but I don't think there are any churches out there who accept gays. And that sucks for my gay friends. And I'm like, I totally understand how complicated the queer relationship is with Christianity in particular and religion in general. Like, I have seen it up close through friends, through family, through my own church. But I also have a lot of friends who are gay and go to church every week. So, like,
absolutely,
it happens.
This is the time everyone. Trey, and Melissa. I don't think I would ever move to New Hampshire, but if any one of you was like, hey, I want to move to the Texas Hill Country to open a small theater, I would say yes.
Considering that I know for a fact that one of our patrons has informed another one of our patrons that she will never retire to New Hampshire, so he should forget that right now. I think it's fair to say that none of us are moving back to New Hampshire, but it's lovely there. Everyone go on vacation. And if you would like to hear more about Rom-Com Killjoys, follow us on social media, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, whatever, at Rom-Com Killjoys for everything, and make sure to like and subscribe. All right. Well, I think it is clear that we are not needing antidotes this week, which is a nice change.
Yes.
So, Janelle, what supplements would you suggest to our listeners?
Well, I have quite a few this week, so everybody strap in. First of all, I want to recommend an academic book, which I know none of you will read unless you're like a hardcore nerd like me, but hey, I just want to let you know that it's out there. On the topic of queer normativity, which is a deeply researched and much debated topic in the interdisciplines, as they're often known, there is an especially good book in my discipline, performance studies, about this topic called Cruising Utopia, The Then and There of Queer Futurity by the late queer scholar Jose Esteban Munoz. It's a beautiful book, really thinking about how a future for queerness does not need to be this sort of normative space, right? And that it can integrate the sort of the complexity of the past that we can sometimes think is too messy for a utopian future. And I don't want to say too much more than that, otherwise I'll go on a tangent, but it's an excellent read, beautiful book if you're down to read some academic literature. The Christmas movie that I want to recommend as my supplement that I had forgotten that I loved is The Family Stone, The Year of Our Lord 2005. Here's why I recommend this movie as a supplement. This movie, 16 years before Single All the Way, I think has an even more nuanced portrayal of an interracial queer couple and a couple where one of the partners is disabled as well, is deaf. The film is beautiful, moving, a believable family dynamic, and the couple, the queer couple in the film, Thad and Patrick, are in the process of adopting a kid, and the movie doesn't shy away from the complexity of how they are perceived by their family versus how they're perceived by the wider community, and it's extremely moving, very real, and just a great Christmas watch overall. And then finally, as we have been doing, I want to recommend another favorite Christmas song of mine. While he has never publicly commented on his sexuality, the singer Sufjan Stevens is often associated with the LGBT plus community, and he wrote one of my personal favorite Christmas songs that I want to add to your playlist, and it is called Christmas in the Room. It's beautiful, it's heartbreaking, it's different, it's a total subversion of this fantasy of going back to your small town at Christmas to be with your family. Instead, it's about being with your partner and making your own Christmas utopia right in your apartment and not leaving. And I love it, love it, love it. Listen to it several times a year. Those are my supplements. What do you have for us, Eliza?
Okay, so one of my supplements, I think I may have recommended this last year, but I'm going to recommend it again for any of you who either weren't listening last year or didn't go and watch this. This is, in fact, there are two Netflix Christmas movies that I think have gone above and beyond the very low quality threshold that I set for Netflix Christmas movies, one of them being the one that we've just talked about, and the other being a film that came out on Netflix last year called Jingle Jangle. Jingle Jangle is a fantastical Christmas Santa Claus-esque movie, but with an entirely black cast, and it has, I mean, the cast is amazing. It's Forest Whitaker, Keegan-Michael Key, like Anika Noni Rose, Felicia Rashad is in it. I mean, the cast is incredible. The little kids in it are so talented and wonderful. And the costuming, the choreography, the new songs in it, they are all just beautiful and fantastical and wondrous. And it has that like fun Christmas spirit that you want when you watch one of these, right? Like we watch a lot of these to hate watch them for this podcast. But theoretically, when you go and watch these movies, it's so that you can just like drink some hot chocolate and eat a candy cane and have Christmas joy. And Jingle Jangle is just like endless Christmas joy combined with endless black girl magic. And it's truly a wonderful film that I think everyone should go watch. So if that's what you're looking for just like a really joyous, wonderful, magical Christmas experience, that is a great movie to go watch. As for music, because we're trying to, you know, continually recommend some great songs for all of y'all. One of my favorite Christmas albums that I have to listen to every year, which again, I think just has that like fun Christmas spirit and joy, is the Muppet Christmas album with John Denver, which is, it's a kind of, it's a weird thing because it's in moments sort of like an art album. Like it's got these like weird songs that they kind of talk through in between the lyrics, and it's about, you know, how like some people find Christmas really hard, but there's a joy there that will save you. And then in the middle of it, there's just like the 12 Days of Christmas as sung by all of the various Muppets with like all of their weird personalities coming out in the middle of it, and like Miss Piggy interrupting everyone, and Beaker and you know me-me-meing along. And it's honestly, like, when you think about it, it's so strange. When you grew up with it, it's completely normal. But it's fun and silly and just, like, a really good way to enjoy Christmas time.
I love the John Denver Muppets Christmas album. It is such an underrated classic.
It's so beautiful. I literally, like, there's a song on it that makes me cry every year when I listen to it. And every other song on the album just makes me die laughing. I mean, like, it's beautiful. It's worth the watch. It's worth the listen.
Yeah. I could not agree more. Well, Eliza, we found a Christmas movie we both like.
Janelle, I genuinely think this is going to like go into my regular Christmas rotation. It was so fun.
Me too. I would watch it again. I'm going to watch it with my parents. I think, and boy, if that's not a sign about representation, I don't know what is, right?
Yeah, everyone should go watch this gay-ass Christmas movie with their parents.
Merry gay Christmas, everyone.
Go don your gay apparel.
Yes, which, you know, that's everything now, as we've discussed. Everything is gay apparel.
That was another great moment when he was like, don that gay apparel, shut up. Thank you for listening to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram.
If you'd like to support us further, you can become a patron at patreon.com/romcomkilljoys.
Our theme song is Lady Slut Hitchhike Love by the band A Giant Dog, and the song you're listening to now is a cover of Baby Love by Colin Langaness.
Remember, Killjoys, don't let anyone kill your joy.
Not a rom-com, not us,
not anyone.
See you next time. Start some kissing and making up.